is a tiny little bit late. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the I'm Well show with your host, Annemieke van Eertva from the Netherlands. And tonight my co-host is Rhonda Harrison. And a good thing she is with her background, because Rhonda has been a certified addiction therapist for over 20 years. And tonight's topic is on drugs. Now, it's not just about drugs. It is a very special topic tonight. It is that drugs are usually supposed to be the thing that gets people addicted, but a new research has discovered now that this is not the case. Rhonda, good evening.
Good evening, Annemieke.
This is going to be an interesting evening, I think.
It should be. It's an interesting topic. I mean, it's one that most people don't like to really look at the real reason the addiction's out there.
Yes, it's an ugly thing to look at, addiction. People don't want to know it, don't want to see it, don't want to deal with it. And that's probably the case why there are very few people who have a good way of getting off of it. Now, the most likely cause of addiction is what we say is the substance itself. And this has been assumed for the longest time. This is what the government wants us to believe and what has been told to us. Now, if we look at society as a whole, we can honestly say that people are more lonely, more alienated from each other, that we live in one-people households, everybody's behind the computer, everybody's constantly on their mobile devices and all that. And that is not helping with having social support, with having real-life friends that you get hugged and can talk and get, you know, a pat on the back and all that. You can even be very lonely within your own family when everybody's busy doing all stuff and behind the computers and household and jobs and all that. Now, there is this Huffington Post, Yohan Hari, and Yohan Hari is quite controversial. He's a journalist. And he says that if you, you know, this story about the substance being the addictive part is so deeply ingrained in our minds that we seem to take it for granted. It seems obvious, okay? It seems manifestly true. And 3.5 years ago, he set off to a 30,000-mile journey around the world for his new book, Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs, to figure out what's really driving the drug war. And he learned that almost everything we've been told about addiction is wrong, and that there are a very different story waiting for us, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. I came across this post only today, and I was so excited about it that I was like, everybody has to hear that. Not everybody gets this post, but everybody has to hear that. So let's make it a show. And a good thing you're here, because you have a great background on drugs and all that. Did you get a chance to read that post, Rhonda?
I've read it over, you know, skimmingly, and then, you know, with being in the field for over 20 years and being sober for 25 years myself, personally, from cocaine, which is the most addictive drug other than alcohol out there, and alcohol
and
is
smoking.
The only drug.
Smoking as well. Smoking is also very, very addictive.
Well,
it's overlooked as a drug.
You don't go through the detoxes that you do with cocaine and alcohol. And alcohol is the only thing that you can detox from that will kill you.
Yes, it could. It could. Depending on how much a person is using, yeah, absolutely. The body can't have the deprivation of the drug, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what this man says is he had early memories about relatives being on drugs, had a partner being on drugs, selling relationships with heroin addicts, and so he felt quite comfortable around these people growing up with them. You know, that's different already. It's a different approach already. And he would have said, you know, he would have looked like an idiot and said, drugs, it's not so difficult to grasp. And he thought he had seen it in his own life and could all explain it like we all think we can, because we've been fed it and refed it and forced down our throats for decades, you know. And if you look at the most potent drugs on the street, it would be heroin and cocaine at the moment. So what does addiction mean? And why, if put on rats, because they did try it on rats, why was there such a big difference in the rats? If you put a rat in a cage alone with two water bottles, and one is just water, and the other is laced with heroin or cocaine, almost every time you run this experiment, a rat will become obsessed with a drug water and keep coming back for more until it kills itself, because it will in the end, as humans do. Now, if then you put the same water bottles in, let's say, a bigger cage where the rat is not alone, he's got friends, he's got good food, he's got things to play with, and, you know, in sort of a rat park, you know, and they tried both water bottles there because they didn't know what was in them. You know, the rats tried both of them, and what that happened was what started everything. The rats with the good lives didn't like the drugged water. They mostly shunned it, consuming less than a quarter of the drugs the isolated rats used. None of them died. And while all the rats who were alone and unhappy became heavy users, none of the rats who had a happy environment did. Now, at first, you would think that's merely a quirk of rats, you know, until it was discovered at the same time at Rat Park experiment, there was a human equivalent test taking place, and it was called the Vietnam War. And looking back at the Vietnam War, Time magazine and also the people there reported that heroin was as common as chewing gum among the U.S. soldiers. And there is solid evidence to back this up. Some 20% of the U.S. soldiers had become addicted to heroin there, according to a study published in the Archives of General Psychiatry. Now, many people were, of course, terrified to believe that, you know, that huge number of addicts was about to head home when the war ended. But in fact, 95% of the addicted soldiers, according to that same study, simply stopped. Very few had rehab. They shifted from a terrifying cage back to a pleasant one. The lonely rat and the rat in a comfortable environment in the rat park. So, they didn't want to drug anymore. So, you know, the mental, emotional drive for a crutch was gone because they were back home, happy families, blah, blah. Now, Professor Alexander argues this discovery is a profound challenge, both to the right viewing that addiction is a moral failing caused by too much hedonistic partying, and the liberal view that addiction is a disease taking place in a chemically hijacked brain. It's not you, it's your cage. Now, they took that test further of the rat part, and they reran the earlier experiments where the rats were left alone and became compulsive users of the drugs. Now, he left them for 57 days. I think you can agree that 57 days can hook you on any drug. at least physically. And then he took him out of isolation and placed him at Red Park. And he wanted to know, if you fall into that state of addiction, is your brain hijacked? So you can't recover? Do the drugs really take over? What happened is, again, striking the rats who had been on the addictive stuff for 57 days seemed to have a few twitches of withdrawal, but that was all. And they soon stopped their heavy use and went back to having a normal life. The good cage saved them. So I was like, you know, very interesting stuff to look at. This is a radical new theory with backup tests and with backup information that this is very much worth looking into when working with people who are addicted. All around you, there are people who have been giving all kinds of drugs in hospitals. Now, if you break your hip or something, it's very painful. You go to a hospital, you would probably be given diamorphine, but that is a medical name for heroin, and most people don't know it. They think, oh, it's morphine. No, it's not. It's heroin. And in the hospital around you, there will be plenty of people also given this diamorphine or heroin for long periods for pain relief. The heroin that you will get from your doctor will have a much higher purity and potency than the heroin being used by street addicts because, you know, to buy from criminals who adulterate it. But that means that the level of addiction and faster addiction in hospital, because of the higher potency, would be there, and people would get out of hospital or off the drug, you know, at the end of the drug, would be addicted. So if the old theory about addiction is right, it's the drug that causes it, that makes your body need them, then it's obvious what should happen. Loads of people should leave hospital and try to score a smack on the street to meet their habit, but there is this strange thing. It virtually never happened. And the Canadian Dr. Gabor Mates was the first to explain to us that medical users just stop, despite months of use. The same drug, used for the same length of time, turns street users into desperate addicts and leaves medical patients ineffective. Strange it is, but looking at the rats isolated in a cage, who have no solace, nothing to turn to, and a medical patient is like the rats in the second cage. They go home to a life where they're surrounded by people they love them, and the drug is the same, but the environment is different, so they give up. They stop. They stop using it without any problem because they have a safety net, a backup, a happy family, friends, job, a normal social life. How do you think about that, Rhonda?
Well, I think that, you know, it is an isolation thing. I mean, when you use and you're an addict, you tend to isolate and be very withdrawn. And that does make sense. You know, I mean, it just is one of those things where each individual is going to recover a little differently. Some will do well in a family unit. Others won't at all. You know, they have to make their own family through, you know, support systems like AA or NA or other 12-step groups, you know, or if it's an eating group or whatever. I mean, they all can be very addictive. And some, you know, are the food, the addiction, and others, it's the drug. You know, it changes that whole chemical set up in your brain, and that's what we're reacting to, responding to after the drug, that, you know, looking for that first initial high that we got the first time, that never happens. And that's the insanity of the addiction, is that you think that you can, you know, one's not enough and a thousand, you know, I mean, one's too many and a thousand is not enough, and people wonder why they have such a hard time in it. Because society is so geared around doing something to anesthetize their feelings of it, smoking, drinking, whatever it is, over exercising, you know, it's about learning how to be with yourself as well, I think.
Yeah, that's what the usual approach would be. And of course, from what you've learned and what you've practiced over a long period of time, coming from that view, that would obviously be true. On the other hand, you mentioned AA, we're going to look at that later, because that also comes up in this, but it's further on. I'm basically going over this very long post, and he explains it very well.
He said
that about 80% of the people does not have the addiction to the substance. The other 20%, on the other hand, have. And that is where you are absolutely right about, you know, those people are absolutely in the way we have been told, but the other 80% are not. And that's what turned out during the whole 30,000 miles that he did and the whole study that he did for his book. And this guy is absolutely a very bright light, not just as a journalist, but in itself, to come up with something like that. Growing up around addicts, not knowing any better, as you know, as we, because this was today. This jumped in my face, and I was like, "Oh, really? I need to read this. You know, this is very interesting because you can help a lot of people looking at it from a different point of view, looking at it from a different approach, because that's what the holistic world is all about. Looking at it from a different approach, right? So." If that were true, if the substance would be addictive, now there is, okay, look at it from another way. You can become addicted to gambling. Nobody thinks you would inject a pack of cards in your veins or any other way of gambling. None of it has chemical hooks like substances have. And this guy went to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting in Las Vegas with permission of everyone present who knew he was there to observe. And they were as plainly addicted as cocaine and heroin addicts are that he is known through his life, yet there are no chemical hooks on craps tables. And he asked, is there a role for some chemicals? And it turns out there is an experiment which gives the answer to this in quite precise terms. It's in Richard de Grandpré's book, The Cult of Pharmacology. And everyone agrees cigarette smoking is one of the most addictive processes around. Chemical hooks on tobacco come from the drug inside called nicotine. So when nicotine patches were developed in the 90s, there was a huge surge of optimism. Cigarette smokers would get all of their chemical hooks without the other filthy and deadly effects of cigarette smoking. They would be freed. Yet, the Office of Surgeon General has found that only 70.7% of cigarette smokers are able to stop using nicotine patches. And that would be about the 20% that he speaks of that is hooked on the substance and not on a mental way, like being, you know, in a cage with a rat. Still, millions of lives are ruined globally by people who die, and it's 20 million worldwide every year. This reveals again that the story we've been taught about the cause of addiction, lying in chemical hooks, in fact is real, but only a minor part of a much bigger picture. Only about 20%. And this has huge implications for the 100-year-old war on drugs and this massive war, which kills people everywhere, as we know, on a daily basis, is based on the claim that we need to physically eradicate a whole array of chemicals because they hijack people's brains and cause addiction. But if drugs aren't the driver of addiction, in fact, it is disconnection that drives addiction, then this makes no sense you know, then the normal accepted approach makes no sense. And the war on drugs actually increases all those larger drivers of addiction. For when you go, he went to Arizona, to a prison called Tent City, where inmates are detained in tiny stone isolation cages for weeks and weeks on end to punish them for drug use. It is as close to a human recreation of the cages with the rats that guaranteed deadly addiction in the rats that were singled out. And with those, when those prisoners get out, they will be unemployable because of their criminal record, guaranteeing they will be cut off even more, and guaranteeing they will stay on the drugs because of the repeating cycle. And if they would have a different approach in wherever on the world, in of course in jails as well, about drugs, like not singling them out, but giving them something more meaningful to do, give them spiritual help in whatever way, whatever the walk of life is. You can build a system that is designed to help drug addicts to reconnect with the world, to leave behind their addictions, which would be, for those 80%, would be a great thing to do. And this isn't theoretical, it's happening. 15 years ago, Portugal had one of the worst drug problems in Europe, with 1% of the population, and that's a lot of people, being addicted to heroin. And they tried a drug war, and the problem just kept getting worse. As we see, you know, singling people out makes it worse. So they decided to do something radically different. They resolved to decriminalize all the drugs and transfer all the money they used to spending on arresting and jailing drug addicts instead on reconnecting them to their own feelings and to the wider society. And the most crucial step is to get them secure housing, subsidized jobs, so they have purpose in life and something to get out of bed for. And this journalist was watching as they were doing that, and as these addicts were helped and in warm, welcoming clinics to learn how to reconnect with their feelings after years of trauma and stunning them into silence with drugs. And he learned that a group of addicts who were given a loan to set up removal firms, suddenly they were a group, all bonded to each other and to the society and responsible for each other's care. And the results of that were, on an independent study by the British Journal of Criminology, and it found that since the total decriminalization of the drugs in Portugal, addiction has fallen, and injection drug use is down by 50%. Injection drug is down by 50% just by the positive approach, by bringing them into a positive environment, giving them something meaningful to do, giving them a job, a house, bringing them back into life, as it were. And that seemed to have a huge, 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 huge impact in a really short amount of time. So decriminalization has been such a manifest success that very few people in Portugal want to go back to the old system. And the only one who was against it is a police guy, the country's top drug cop. And he offered all the dire warnings that we all know from Daily Mail, Fox News, you name it, the whole blah, blah about the normal thing and all that. But when this journalist met up with the police officer, João Figueira, and they sat down to talk, this officer told him that everything he had predicted had not come to pass, and he now hopes the whole world will follow Portugal's example. Now, that says a whole lot. And this isn't only relevant to addicts that he was connected with. It is relevant to all of us because it forces us to think differently about ourselves. human beings are, you know, humans are group animals, if I may call it that, bonding animals. We need to connect. We need to love. We need to touch. If you don't touch a baby, it will die. If you just only have it, you know, operated by machines, so to speak, robots, no human touch, no love, no caress, it will die. They already have studies on that. So that shows how important it is to be held, hugged, loved, cared for, to have human connections. And not just over the internet, no, real life and real touch and real hold and real look at a person and have interaction in a positive way. But sadly, we've created an environment and a culture that cut us off from connection or offer only a parody of it offered by the internet. The rise of addiction is a symptom of a deeper sickness in the way we live, constantly directing our gaze towards the next shiny object we could buy rather than the human beings all around us. And keep that thought. We are going to a very short commercial break, and we will be back in a few minutes to resume this topic. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the RBR Network of radio shows. The RBR Network and the Rimpert Broadcast Network are a part of a program being developed by James Rimpert Powell, founder of the Institute of Applied Metaphysics and the creator of the Radio by Rimpert Network. The RBR Network page is at www.blogtalkradio.com/Rimpert, R-E-N-F-O-R-D. We encourage you to also check out Rimpert Broadcast Network at www.youtube.com. On Monday evenings at 6:30 p.m. Central Standard Time, we have Pam Drennan with the Cosmic Contact Show, and at 8 p.m. it is Keith Blanchard with the Searchers Roadmap Show. Then on Tuesday at 8 p.m. it is Anamika with the I Am Well Show. On Wednesday at 7 p.m. it is The No Show, hosted by Reverend Robert J.V. McMillan. At 8:30 p.m., James Rimpert Powell hosts the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program, a 54-week program including support material and online coaching. On Thursday evenings, it is Daryl Clark coming to you from New York with the Progressive News Weekly at 5:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. Saturdays at 6:30 p.m., Eddie Milton is the host on Night Search, a program that has been on the air for 13 years. On Sunday at 11 a.m., the Core Concepts Show broadcasts the Core Concepts Lectures, which are held each Sunday. These are recordings of the Core Concept Lectures that we have each Sunday at 4:30 p.m. Central Standard Time in Memphis, Tennessee. And on Fridays and Sundays at 3 p.m. Central Standard Time, we will feature recordings from our affiliate station, Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. The Bookman Television Show is broadcast on the Comcast Cable Network in Memphis each Saturday at 9:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. The Bookman Show, the Core Concepts Lectures, and the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program are all on the YouTube.com. You can access them by going to the Rimpert Broadcast Network channel. We would like to invite you to visit the virtual campus of the Institute of Applied Metaphysics at www.im-cor.org. The books are available in the bookstore, and you can view all three degree levels of the Institute. There are three free e-books, a free e-zine you can download called Lightways, and an information packet for first-time authors called the Author Packet. Before we get back to our show, we want to invite you to go to the website of the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program at thelawsofmaterialwealth.com. Provides a look at the most comprehensive, interactive, and proactive personal development program available today. It includes the Laws of Material Wealth book, the workbook by the same name, 4 DVDs, a CD, an infomercial, 3 commentary outlines, and 54 weeks of support material and online coaching. Thank you for listening to the RBR Network of Shows. Enjoy the show.
And we're back after the break. For those who tune in later, we are discussing drugs and normal approach, as I might say, that it is the drug that causes the addiction. And we have been talking about a lot of studies and tests that have been done over time, and that clearly show that this is only the case in 20% of the addicts. The others are socially singled out, socially lonely, even though they might have a family. You can be lonely in a mass of people and still feel very lonely. And as the writer George Monbiot called it, this is the age of loneliness, where we have created human societies where it is easier for people to become cut off from all human connections than ever before. And Mr. Bruce Alexander, the creator of the Red Park that we discussed earlier, said that for too long, people have talked exclusively about individual recovery from addiction. We need now to talk about social recovery, how we all recover together from the sickness of isolation that is sinking us like a thick fog over us, a big blanket that, you know, that we can't see each other anymore. So this new evidence isn't just a challenge politically. It doesn't just force us to change our mind. It forces us to change our heart, because loving an addict is really, really hard. You know, looking at addicts, it's very tempting to follow the tough love advice doled out by, you know, reality shows and by the government and whatever, you know, tell the addict to shape up or cut them off. The message is that an addict who won't stop should be shunned. And it's the logic of the drug war imported into our private lives. And in fact, the only thing that will happen is that they deepen their addiction, and you may lose them altogether. If you look at it, it is better to let them know how you love them unconditionally, whether they stop or whether they can't. And when he came back from his journey, this journalist looked at his ex-boyfriend in withdrawal, and he thought about him differently. And you know, for a century now, we've been singing war songs on addicts, and it occurred that we should be singing love songs to them all along. Now, Rhonda, after all these tests that, you know, that are being discussed, that this man brought up in one long article in the Huffington Post, and his name is Johan Hari, J-O-H-A-N-N-H-A-R-I, Johan Hari. And he's an Englishman with a strange name, nevertheless, but he is an Englishman. Now, looking at the full story of his journey, and it can be read in Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs, wouldn't you say, Rhonda, that there is absolutely a future in approaching it from a complete new angle if we want to help drug-addicted people?
Well, when I was working in the field, I was working in halfway houses and detox centers, and a lot of what I did was help people get subsidized housing and helping them go back to school and getting supported to get a job. And those mm-hmm. that would fit into that realm did quite well. And I think that if we're going to do it in a humanitarian way without the shame and the, you know, isolation that we tend to do, which we obviously can see is not beneficial to the person or to society, because it costs both of them, you know. And so I think more of a socialization situation, and where there is also a therapeutic piece to it, I think that is the way to see long-term recovery for people and for them to find that they have a life that's worth living.
Absolutely, absolutely. I agree. It will be very hard to get this done politically, but when it starts in the one-on-one, if you have someone in your family or a friend of yours, a colleague of yours that you see is becoming addicted, or that you find out that they are addicted, You could try this approach because for 80% of the drug addicts, this is the way to approach them. And of course, there is the 20% that actually are hooked on the drug itself, that actually are addicted to the drug themselves. And he said that already at the beginning. But those 20%, you know, are the difficult people, is what I want to call them. And there is an addiction clinic on Hawaii called Habitat. And if you are one of the 20% who is not in isolation, or if an approach other like to get you out of your isolation, etc., would not help you, then go to Habitat by all means, because they have the highest recovery rate of everyone. And besides that, Robert Smith of Faster EFT goes there every 6 months with a team of at least 12 high-grade practitioners, and they help the people there to get rid of their addictions. And they work on as many people as they can throughout 10 days. And they come back every 6 months to follow up. And the people they have worked on so far over the past 5 years have recovered and not relapsed. So that's a great thing. So keep it in mind, if you really, you know, if the social approach would not work on you, if you don't find yourself isolated and all that, and you still have a drug problem, go to a Habitat. That, having that being said, we looked at Portugal, Rhonda, and in Portugal they put people in subsidized jobs, you know, using all the money on drug war in a positive way, helping them to get back to their feelings, to socialize, jobs, houses. If you look at how much money the United States spends per year on drug war, it's a gigantic amount of money. I don't know how much it is, but it's an amazing amount. If that would be put to use in the way we just discussed, what do you think? What would the impact be?
I think the impact would be huge. I mean, I've watched it with, you know, like I said, in the programs where I worked at Stepping Stones in Denver, Colorado, in, you know, pretty much the thick of not a real good area of Denver. And then I've, you know, seen, you know, a house full of 13 women learn to have to get together and work together and communicate and learn how to eat together and take time to cook meals together and plan meals, and, you know, and then knowing that there were limits, but yet, you know, that the treatment wasn't so expensive that they couldn't afford it and afford to work and work on themselves at the same time. And it was an amazing program. And, you know, a lot of us are still sober from that program. And I mean, I went through it myself and then became a house manager, then later became an addictions counselor, and then worked in the field in Glenwood Springs and in Denver again, and always worked in that setting. And when they're supported like that, you see a longer term of recovery with no relapse, if they ever relapse again.
There you go. There you go. Another proof, another test, if you will. You know, it's a test every time. Is it one of the 80% or is it one of the 20%? Because they need a different approach altogether. But yeah, you found out already over the past 2 decades what this man has, you know, recently found out and wrote a book about, that this is really working, that there is hardly any relapse, if at all, and that people are, you know, what you expressed really well is learn to work together, learn to cook together. They have to relearn all kinds of social skills that we think is normal, but that mm-hmm. those people don't have anymore. The age
maybe
of loneliness.
Had.
Maybe mm-hmm. never had. It's maybe how they grew up. A lot of people grow up around people who are addicted, have one as a parent, as a sibling, you know, other family members, friends of the family, In school, God knows they are everywhere, and it's often very hidden. There's a lot of people who have a normal job and who are still addicted, who get their shots before they go to work or in between or whatever, and they do it in a way that it's not too obvious that they still function, at least so it seems. And yeah, well,
so I was one of those functioning addicts.
Absolutely.
Worked two jobs and did cocaine all night and then would be back at work at 8 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, I didn't do it as well as I thought I did.
Well,
you know, obviously I failed because I haven't done it for 25 years now and I have no desire to ever touch cocaine again.
There you go. You succeeded. You know, the program worked on you, so why wouldn't it work on anyone else?
And it was a socialization program, you know, where you were supported socially, you know, economically, physically, you know, medically.
Exactly. Now, if that worked on you, Rhonda, looking at yourself before you became addicted, would you say that you found yourself lonely, not supported, etc.?
Yeah.
Because I know what background you came from and that you stepped sort of away from it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And would that have resulted in a cutting you off from the connection to them? To your family and all that?
My family?
Yeah.
I did cut off from my family for quite a while and then have slowly re-entered and then in the last year have like been engulfed in my family like I've never been before. Well, since I started working with the RBR network, I've done a lot of more socialization with my family than I'd had in most of my whole lifetime.
Right.
Because I had allowed other people to show me how to develop those relationships and how to truly forgive and realized that they did the best that they could with what they had at the time. And that, you know, everybody's got their story. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Without a doubt, from their point of view, from the place where they were, they did the best they could within their upbringing, within their walk of life, their beliefs. Yes, absolutely. Doesn't mean they were bad people, just, you know, with how you were and how they were. It didn't work very well at the time.
Exactly.
And now, after all this time, and you've been through a lot and learned a lot, you say that only in the last year you learned through the radio shows a few skills that enabled you to actually reach out to them and connect back to them in a way better than ever before. So that actually is another proof to what this, you know, young writer said about addiction being a social problem. The age of loneliness also connected with people being unable to socialize, people being unable to have certain social skills for whatever reason. And in this modern day and age, of course, the devices everybody has, the smartphones, the tablets, the computers, the music in their ears, blah, 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 contributes to that immensely.
And that's very true. And we have become a very I-centered society where we really need to be a we-centered society so that we do have those social skills. Society and the media have taught us to be afraid, don't trust, don't reach out, don't, you know, let anybody know what you're doing or, you know, this and that. You know, really it's about being honest with, you know, this hurts, you know, I don't like it when you do that or speak to me like this, you know, and I don't think that up until this time of awareness and enlightenment that we're in, have we ever been more aware that, you know, if we want to make a change, we need to step out, be the first one to have that hand reaching out to help someone.
Right, exactly. And if you look at your experiences, if you look at our society, I think it would be a good thing if it started in the home with the parents not giving their children mobile phones, smartphones, tablets, you name it. If there is a computer in the house for school, that's fine. We all need that. You can't do without a computer for school anymore nowadays. Okay? You can't. I know that. My daughter's 25. When she was 14, she needed a computer. Right? So if it is required for schoolwork, absolutely. Okay? But the time that you need to spend on that for school is limited. You don't have to be on there all day, every day. And it can be a desktop computer instead of a laptop. So, that they need to sit in a special place to actually use it. And no mobile devices, no laptops, no tablets, no mobile smartphones. If you want to give your kid a phone because you are working and you want to have a safe connection, that just in case something happens and you are late, or the child has been detained at school for whatever reason, that you can let that know to each other so that, you know, that not one of you freaks out for it. That's okay. But for that, you only need a very simple cell phone, which you can call with and send a text with. That's all it needs to be able to do. And then with a very limited amount of money on it, you know, let's say just maybe $10 a month or something. Now, if they want to go texting their friends, that will be gone very fast. So that's where it starts. Everything starts in the home. And I've seen those comical little pictures, or they're meant to be comical, that, you know, people are sitting next to each other on a bench in the park texting each other. It is a bit overdone, but that is how it works. People are texting each other while sitting not even 5 steps away from one another. And then I'm like, okay, guys, why don't you just, you know, talk?
Or use your imagination. I nannied little boys, and the first thing that goes when I'm nannying, because I live in a small village called Red Feather Lakes, Colorado, and the first thing that goes is they're not allowed to have any iPads, any type of game devices, anything like that. They have to use their imagination and, you know, go out and learn plants or whatever, or rocks or whatever they are drawn to. And I get a big, you know, oh my gosh, I can't live without it, to, wow, this is a lot of fun and I don't even miss it anymore. You know, and, you know, having that as a babysitter is not good.
No.
You know, and I see that with a lot of parents. Here, just give them the iPad.
Yeah.
No.
Shut them up in the corners. Like give them candy, and now it's give them an iPad.
And then it's like, then give them the drug.
Yeah. Yes. They're almost handing them the needle. Almost, yes.
Yeah.
Almost. And I don't think that people realize that, because this is a very new approach in itself. I mean, you have experienced it over time already, you know, decades ago, but it's not a common approach. The common approach is you have to detox, right? And that only works for 20%, and the other 80% need the social approach, need to be loved and taken care of for, and to get a meaningful life, because there are so many people out there having a meaningless life, have no goals, no hopes and dreams, come out of, I would say they come out of a hopeless situation. It's more that they're hopeless themselves because of whatever happened to them. And addicts come out of all layers of society. It doesn't at all discriminate from what background you come. There are people in all layers of the income scale, let's put it that way, poor people, rich people, and everything in between, and it hits everybody. and it devastates families. And someone I know from very up close has gone through it and has gone off it, and yet the family is still in fear, like, oh my God, I hope that this person doesn't go connecting back to the people who actually got them addicted in the beginning. That fear is still with them. And I actually had a little talk about that and said, well, there is so many people now in this person's life that are keeping an eye on it and are regularly asking, hey, how are you doing? Where have you been? And all that. And this person has a goal in life right now, has a a spiritual calling, if I may say. And it's very strong in that belief, and actually it's giving a lot of his time, his money in educating himself in that area, has a lot of back support, and therefore doing a lot better. So there's proof again, that this is an amazing way of getting people out of the isolation, out of angriness, out of resentment, out of rejection, out of abandonment, whatever, things as much as a divorce can trigger people off into you doing drugs, you know, and I mean the kids. And it can be a lot worse than parents even can imagine. If your kid is doing drugs, try to approach them in this way. I know you're, of course, scared of the effects on the rest of your family, other children and all that, and it won't be easy. But ask for support. Ask for support. Keep asking for support. And I don't think that it will be very easy to get this into the White House, would it?
You know, it's so interesting because right now they're trying, I'm watching them scramble, you know, living here in the United States and watching what they're doing with the war on drugs and how it's hardly even spoken of anymore since there's been such a change in the marijuana laws in the United States. Different mm-hmm. states. It seems like, you know, all of a sudden, you know, they don't know what to do. And it's like, come on, you know, let's put this money into rehabbing these people by actually teaching them the social skills that they've never learned and probably have never had the opportunity to learn, you know, and let them know that they are a worthwhile person in society. They just have never been given the opportunity to show that part because they've always been struggling.
Yes. Exactly. And, you know, and especially in the United States, I would say it's a very shark-like environment. It's you make it on your own or you don't make it, and everybody has to fight for themselves. And, you know, it's really the type of thing that would have been around when people in the beginning had to go into Indian country, if I may say it like that, and had to fight off the native people, had to fight off their neighbors, had to fight off intruders that came in and wanted to steal their land and all that. And that was every man for themselves. But that was a long time ago, and people need to grow out of that and get another mindset. And I think that is the whole idea. Teaching people another mindset, a more productive mindset, and not everybody in their own little apartment, you know, doing their job, and it's, you know, work, eat, sleep in the rat race. But excuse me, but that there is a lot more than that. That there is, you know, that people need to connect more than the high and buy stuff and more than sitting in a classroom together, because you can be lonely in a group of 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm. So true.
Oh, gee, I see that we're almost at the end of our show already. We have 2 minutes left. That went fast.
Did.
It absolutely went fast. Well, this was a very interesting show about Johan Hari's book. And it's called Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. It's published by Bloomsbury. Everybody's praised this book already, and you can read more about it at www.chasingthescream.com. Books are available on internet. Just, you know, try Amazon or any bookstores. You can probably order it. Johan Hari, Johannhari. And Rhonda, thank you so much for being my life support for today and my back office support and a very interesting conversational partner with all your experience.
Yeah, it's interesting how Spirit put me in this place today, and I had no idea
yes.
what we were going to do.
Rhonda, you know, how can people reach you?
They can reach me at Search. I'm also the host for the Searchers Roadmap on Fridays at 1 p.m. Central Time. You can reach me at searchersroadmap@gmail.com, at Rhonda Harrison at on Facebook, and the shamans that are coming into the United States soon and in different places.
Your website.
That's what I mostly focus on.
Your website, hummingbirdhealingoils.com.
Yes.
And you can find me on crystallinetherapies.com, www.crystallinetherapies.com. There's a contact form on there if you want to reach out to me. You can see all my services there. You can also email me directly at innersightmedium@gmail.com. This was the show for today. Thanks, Rhonda, for being my wonderful backup again. Thanks for the audience for listening, and I see you all next week with another very interesting show. Have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Bye.